Thank you. And I want to, first of all, thank the conveners for putting on the show, and also for my co-authors, who are at a variety of different institutions. We had, this is part of a much larger project that was looking at pharmaceutical transport in soil at a variety of different scales, from laboratory scale at the bench scale to the mesoscale with small isometers, and the next speaker will talk about that. And my role was to look at the field scale, where irrigation with recycled water is being has been used for many decades on active fairways and golf courses. And there's a lot of motivation behind this. Recycled water is considered it's a huge asset for areas of the country that are water limited. We're in San Antonio right now, that's experiencing a drought of record. So San Antonio is virtually an arid setting right now for the last 12 months. So recycled water and other kinds of strategies like that become very, very important. But at the same time, there's really lingering questions on what's in the recycled water and what happens to the compounds that are in that after being used as an irrigation source on turf and parks and things like that. So through the motivation of Mike McCullough, who is a co-author at the Northern California Golf Association, we were able to put together a consortium of 17 utilities and 5 universities and the Southern Nevada Water Authority to really try to look at this at multiple scales. And so the goals for what I'll try to describe here is to monitor water flow and selected pharmaceutical concentrations at field scale in areas that differ by soil, climate, and depth of groundwater. And just to understand what the attenuation mechanisms are in what the previous speaker was calling the living zone, I think, which is basically the rhizosphere of the turf roots and the soil in the top, really, 60 centimeters or so of soil. And so this is just a laundry list of the compounds that we were looking at. For people who are measuring these, understand that they're very, very expensive, about $1,000 a sample to analyze. These were all done with participation by Southern Nevada Water Authority as well as JGAN at UC Riverside. So we were trying to run through what amounted to several thousand samples in both laboratory and the mesoscale and in the field scale to analyze for these compounds. And I have them sort of broken down by color, whether antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, and antidepressants, which is what we ended up taking after some of our instruments died in the field. And these are the locations of the field sites. We have a Mediterranean climate at both San Jose, California, and Industry, California, and then we have arid settings in Palm Desert and in Henderson. The soils varied a little bit by silt loam to sand, so we have some variability, some experimental control, but really, you know, when you're looking at an area that's this broad, it's very tough to get really hard and fast and nail down the independent variables here. This is just some basic site information. So Wild Horse is arid. That's in Henderson, Nevada, and that's the first one. And then Palm Desert Country Club, which is the last one, that's also arid, and that's in Palm Desert, California. And then Silver Creek and Zaharias are in San Jose and City of Industry, respectively. And you can see that the soils vary quite a bit by texture. The cation exchange capacity also varies quite a bit if you're looking at the sandy soil down in Palm Desert. And then we have a variety of different water table depths, which vary from shallow to deep. And the shallow part actually becomes a little bit of an issue with some of the instruments that we're working on, and I can describe that. So the field setup, we were using passive capillary drain gauges, which are also known as the GEE that Glendon GEE developed years ago, back in around the turn of the century. These are made available by Decagon, and Decagon is showing them off downstairs, and there's, in fact, representatives here that will be happy to speak with you about them. We were installing them 15 centimeters below ground surface, so the top of the gauge was below where the verticutting and the aeration processes are in the turf so that it wouldn't damage the top of the gauge. They were all installed on an active fairway so that the treatment across the entire fairway would be uniform. And then we collected samples. So these are actual water samples that are draining through 60 centimeters of soil and into collection cups. And then we sample the water from the collection cups. So there's no need to collect soil and then do the extraction process off of the soil. We also measure temperature, water content, and EC at a couple of sites using 5TE gauges, also available from Decagon. And then the system was basically placed in the ground and then monitored for a two-year period from essentially January of 2009 to December of 2010. And this is just a picture of the gauge, and I'll try to get the mouse to work here. So this, which is known as a flow divergence tube, or a stovepipe is what I call it. It's basically 60 centimeters high. It's made out of stainless steel. And then inside here is a wick, and the wick basically is 60 centimeters long. So when water goes through the soil, it hits the wick, and it creates 60 centimeters of potential on the soil itself. The water then drains into sampling cups, which are found down here. And then we sample the water as we go out to the field to download the data. And this everything is collected with a data logger, so we can see really down to the sub-millimeter of water flow, what the flow rates are, and when they're occurring relative to irrigation events and changes in weather. And then this is a picture taken immediately afterwards, but very quickly the turf grows up around it, and we really actually had a hard time trying to find where the gauges were. So very quickly it becomes part of the sort of the landscape, and it worked quite well. We then took the water flow, which is, of course, it's in cubic centimeters. We then tried to place that in terms of a vertical flux, so we divided by the cross-sectional area of the stovepipe. And then we took the concentration that we were measuring in nanograms per liter, we multiplied it by the water, so we can come up with a total amount of nanograms that are moving through the soil. We then normalize that across, and we essentially express it in a per hectare basis, something that just allows us to compare from site to site. So this is just a table of numbers here. The first four columns are where we collected the water from. So we were able to get a number of samples, close to 40 samples, from the gauge themselves. It's not a huge amount of water, but realizing that these golf courses are deficit irrigating, and we're really only getting breakthrough during winter rain periods and during overseeding. So, but we also took water directly from the irrigation source, so we could see what the source term was, and in some cases we were able to get water from irrigation ponds where they're storing the recycled water before it's then pumped out into the system. And Lena and Dale Devitt installed a water well that was immediately adjacent to the flux gauges. Now, the last column on the right is actually pretty important, because that shows how long it took for the system to equilibrate. And one of the issues with these gauges is how to get an undisturbed block of soil inside the stovepipe. We tried multiple ways to do this. We tried drilling it down. We really went through heroic efforts, but we're in the middle of a golf course, and so we had to hit the deck many times as these duffers would hit the golf ball, and it would aim right toward us. And so we had to be out there and do it quickly so that we would avoid head injuries from golf balls. And so we had to take the soil and repack the soil to the approximate bulk density of the soil itself and get everything in the ground and do it in essentially in real time. But you can see it took 6 months to a year, in some cases longer, for the system to equilibrate, for us to actually get water to flow through. And that ended up requiring no-cost extensions and to extend the monitoring period to 2 years. But the data that we were getting was really quite good. And once we started getting breakthroughs, so this dash line here is for Silver Creek, and this is showing just the water flow over time. And the 730 days is about a two-year period. And you can see it took about a year or so for really all the gauges to kick in. And this corresponds to the overseeding periods that the golf courses use when they're going from essentially a warm summer turf to a cool winter turf. And I have the total fluxes, the cumulative flux at Silver Creek was 117 millimeters. This is the Mediterranean climate. We got a lot of water flow here. Some of this could have been just from the high water table actually moving up into the zone of where the monitoring was. So we look at that a little bit. We're not certain about those numbers. Palm Desert was 76. Palm Desert itself, although it has a very sandy soil, the irrigation was intermittent because the golf course essentially went bankrupt, and then they had to turn the irrigation system off and on. So we were dealing with that a little bit. And Zaharias, which is in industry, and Wild Horse, which is in Henderson, had pretty good numbers. But you can see how low the fluxes really were, only 21 millimeters of water flow at Wild Horse in a two-year period. You can just see how really tightly managed the water is. And that becomes important because the concentration of the contaminants or the pharmaceuticals isn't really the issue. It's the mass flux. So you really need to look at the amount of water times the concentration, which then is what's feeding into local groundwater or into other surface bodies. And we found it was very, very small. You can see the total amount of source, both precip and irrigation at Wild Horse, was over 3,000 millimeters with only 21 millimeters of flux that came through the bottom. So it's a very, very small amount of water. If we look at the instances of the compounds that are above the reportable limits, and these limits were somewhat dependent on the volume of the sample, but they were all down in the nanogram per liter level. I'm highlighting carbamazepine, meprobamate, and sulfamethoxazole because these were the three compounds that were consistently found in most of the samples. And you can see the number of instances down on the bottom is the total. So we had 111 instances of sort of positive hits of compounds over the period, with Silver Creek being accounting for about half of all of the positive hits that we had, which was actually interesting because this was the clayiest soil of them all. So we're not really sure how to sort of rectify that. It's a little bit puzzling. But also Palm Desert, even with very, very small amounts of water input because the irrigation sources were turned off, we still had a relatively high number, I think, of non-zero or detectable limits. Here's the concentration ranges of the things that we found, and on the last column is what's known as the human health threshold. And this was determined by a panel that was working for the state of California. Shane Snyder was on the panel and was one of our collaborators. And so this is not necessarily a reference dose, like an EPA reference dose, because they don't exist for all these compounds. But essentially, you can see how high they are. They're in the typically in the tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of nanograms. And yet the values that we were seeing were somewhere even in the feed water, they were down around from non-detects to 1,000. That varied from time to time. But in the drain gauges themselves, there was a large attenuation, in some cases multi-decadal attenuations of the concentrations, only moving through 60 centimeters of soil and turf. So we saw that as being very, very effective in terms of an attenuation mechanism within the soil. And it could be microbial degradation, it could be sorption, it could be typical just half-life decay. And the other studies that were being done for this project were also looking at those processes. If we just look at the mass flux, and this is, I'm just using Silver Creek as an example, you can see basically long periods of sort of quiescence followed by sort of jumps, and these jumps, again, correspond to changes in irrigation as well as changes in weather. So where we have very large precip events or we're shifting over from a warm season grass to a cold season grass. And in terms of the mass flux on a per hectare basis, this is in milligrams per hectare. We're basically looking at values that were around 14 milligrams, 1.82. And so these values are really quite low. In terms of whether there's a health impact, you know, that's sort of left to the people who do the health sciences type studies and those kinds of dosages. But we found this to be very, very moderate levels of flux. And again, this is only in the top 60 centimeters of soil. So if we were to translate that down to another 2 meters or 3 meters before we hit the water table, we would have much longer transport times as well as contact periods within the soil that's likely to reduce the concentrations even further. And so just as an overall summary, we found that carbamazepine, meprobamate, and sulfamethoxazole were the most prevalent and found across all of the 13 compounds that we looked at. You can see we did get some hits for other compounds, and we had several that were gone completely from the samples. The decrease in concentration we saw was really quite significant from the feed water down to 60 centimeters. So from the standpoint of whether, you know, there's a large-scale health risk of using recycled water in parks and in irrigation, you know, irrigating fields and things like that, we found that to be very, very low. Is it risk less? Probably not. But is it, you know, given relative risk and where we are in the world, it's probably fairly safe water source. But the riskiest condition is really where you're looking at overseeding on top of a sandy soil with a shallow water table. And so it's probably smart to try and really deficit irrigate that kind of field condition to avoid having any deep and rapid flushes of water through the soil and to some groundwater or other surface water body. And with that, I'll stop and take any questions if you have any. Thanks.
was the material that was used to create the 60 centimeter tension within the sampling device, the water sampling device?
It's basically a wick material, and I don't know what the wick itself is made of, but there have been a number of studies looking at sorption of compounds on the wicks. All the rest of the material inside was all inert material.
Okay, so the wick itself, you don't know what sorption characteristics are for some of the compounds?
I don't. It's a good question. Yeah.
That decarbonized device is pretty small area.
Right.
And even the center soil, we can see preferential transport. Right? So, do you do any implications, or how
does this result? You know, that's a good question, and it's very hard to tell if there's preferential flow either around the stovepipe or within it itself. We did our best to pack the soil carefully back into the stovepipe to avoid any large areas of preferential flow. And, you know, when we were out there, we just essentially did the best that we could. The 60-centimeter depth is essentially used for a wide variety of soil textures, so we don't think that we're biasing more water going into the device or we're excluding water. But at the same time, there could have been some, it's possible that it's preferential flow. I mean, this is a problem in all soil water sampling, you know, where we're trying to measure things like this. In the absence of taking a physical sample, we didn't know that there was too many other opportunities for us. Yep.
Is it part of your study to look at the surface runoff?
It wasn't, and these fields are irrigated in a way that avoids surface runoff. So it's a pretty high roughness coefficient, and it's really the golf course superintendents are very careful to avoid having ponded conditions anywhere on their field, in part because they're irrigating on an active fairway, so they don't want to ruin the turf. So this is something that they manage, but we had no visible runoff anywhere during the study.
Okay, then that's interesting stuff. Then we will take the next speaker.
Okay, thanks.
If you have any other questions, we can talk about it after that.